The meeting of the Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum, so Senator Higgins?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senate File 2385.
Could we start out by passing out the A1 amendment, please? It's a delete all. So.
Okay.
Yes, we'll talk about what we're going to talk about.
I'm going to put the bill in shape. The author would like to discuss it.
I'll so move the amendment
Senator
to get it.
Senator Metzen moves the A1 amendment. I'll just wait till everybody has a copy, but.
I talked to Senator Higgins about this earlier today.
All those in favor, then, of the author's amendment as moved by Senator Metzen, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, sign. The motion prevails. You have the bill the way you'd like to discuss it in any case.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Metzen. In January of this year, the Associated Press released a report that cadmium is appearing in children's jewelry. Cadmium is ranked number 7 on the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's priority list of the 275 most hazardous substances. Cadmium is a carcinogen. It has been shown to cause developmental problems in small children. And it doesn't even have to be ingested for exposure. Children can suck on or bite a product to be exposed to high levels of cadmium. And we all know that children put everything in their mouths when they're certain ages. Chinese manufacturers are attempting to circumvent the prohibition of lead in products and are adding cadmium instead of the safe alternative, which is zinc. It is clear that some countries will not stop circumventing our laws when it comes to producing jewelry and toys cheaply, so it makes it imperative that we stay proactive in protecting our consumers from harmful metals like cadmium. In 2007, I authored a bill here in the Minnesota Senate that banned lead from kids' toys and jewelry. Senator Amy Klobuchar then authored a similar bill in the United States Senate, and both bills received bipartisan support and were passed into law. And this was the start of an era where we were once again thinking about the products that are in the toys and jewelry and other items that our kids are exposed to. However, the recent finding of cadmium in many of these same products has renewed the discussion on how safe those imported items really are. As our U.S. senators look at the issue on the federal level, I'm putting forward this legislation here in our state so that we can ensure that the necklaces, bracelets, toys, charms that our littlest Minnesotans play with are safe. I don't think that any of us wants to sit idly by and wait for another tragedy, as happened in 2007, to galvanize us into ensuring that the products that we buy continue to be safe. I also think that we don't want to wait until the federal government gets safe standards passed. We know that the states are much more nimble than Congress and the U.S. Senate. The amendment before you is a result of the meeting I had this morning with retailers and other folks in the industry, and I believe that they brought up some good information that I didn't know, and so I'm hoping that we will pass this bill as we have presented it. We have Tony Quillis here also to speak on behalf of I suppose I should tell you what this bill does. It's pretty straightforward. The prohibition in using cadmium is at a level of 75 parts per million on surface coatings or whatever might be accessible internally to a product that might be accessible if you ingested it or held it or whatever. There's heavy reference to ASTM safety specifications, and those are specifications at the federal level. So we aren't getting sideways with what the Consumer Product Safety Commission and other federal agencies who sort of regulate these products have. So I will turn it over to Mr. Quillis, and he will add on to the discussion, I think.
Welcome, Mr. Quillis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Higgins, my name is Tony Quillis. I sit here before you today representing the Fashion Jewelry Trade Association. I'll just make a couple of brief comments, and then there's two gentlemen here that are intricately involved in this issue nationwide and can give you a lot of background on the issue as this bill moves forward. I think it has one or two more stops. The senator from South St. Paul, I think, has a request in for it, as well as the Judiciary Committee. But I'm not sure that there was a Attorney General provision, but I think probably Mr. Stanton could help me. But I think under 18.3.1, they probably would still have the enforcement of this. Well, but anyway, Madam Chair, I wanted to thank Senator Higgins. As the bill was introduced and we move forward, we had a conversation this morning. The Fashion Jewelry Trade Association, the Minnesota Retailers Association, represented by Buzz Anderson, who is also here with a member, and the Toy Industry Association, Mr. Andy Hackman. And we had a great meeting with Senator Higgins this morning to point out some issues that we had with the bill as introduced, and to point out to her that this issue is not new to us in the Fashion Jewelry Trade Association. We are working. There are a number of task force. We're working with the Consumer Product Safety Commission, because right now there are no standards federally for cadmium. So we're trying to work something along those ways. These references you see here are to the European Union, and so we're going to try and work along with those. But right now, as we move this bill forward, and Senator Higgins and I think, will still continue. I have a good working relationship, as she mentioned previously, on the lead legislation that moved forward. And as this moves forward, I think we're still, there might be some wordsmithing on both our sides as we move forward to look through to it. But I just wanted to do some brief introductions and turn it over now to Michael Gale from the Fashion Jewelry Trade Association and Andy Hackman from the Toy Industry Association. These gentlemen have been working on this on state by state and on the federal issue, and they can give you a little bit more background information on what's going on and to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Mr. Gale and Mr. Hackman, feel free to come up to the table. Mr. Gale, going to go first?
Yes,
okay.
Madam Chairman,
you'll
thank
introduce
you.
Yourself. Thank you.
Hi, yes, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Michael Gale. I'm the executive director of the Fashion Jewelry Trade Association. I've been in the fashion jewelry industry all my working life, and both as a manufacturer and a sales representative, and for the last 5 years with the Fashion Jewelry Trade Association. And we appreciate the work Senator Higgins has done. We worked with her on the Minnesota law pertaining to lead in the products when the tragedy occurred with the child here in the state. And a very effective law was implemented, and we're pleased that the state is so concerned, as is the fashion jewelry industry, because the safety of our products reflects upon us and is certainly the number one priority of all the manufacturers, suppliers, and retailers that that sell the product. And it's estimated that about 80% of all retailers in the state of Minnesota sell some aspect of fashion jewelry, whether it be at a drugstore, a convenience store, or a department store. So we certainly stepped forward to address the concern about lead in jewelry, and as I mentioned, we supported that legislation, which was very much based on science and technical feasibility, and the standards that were set are still the effective standards, and that's worked very well. We're supporting studies with many industries for all the heavy metals. We feel that it shouldn't be lead 2 years ago, and now it's cadmium, and then it's going to be antimony, and there are eight heavy metals that are of concern, and we are going forward with testing and risk assessment studies on all of those heavy metals. We're working very closely with CPSC as they are doing the studies as well independently, and then we'll all share information. The industry, ours and the toy industry and others have very good relationships, working relationships with CPSC. So I would just very, very quickly like to tell you that the jewelry industry, after the concerns about lead, and it was at that time using metals mostly comprising of tin, but there was some lead in there for strength and other reasons. When we had to go away from tin because there was just going to be more lead than was going to be allowed, the industry did move to zinc as a metal that would work in the same molds. But there is some cadmium, as the senator referred to it, that comes out of the ground with zinc. So the EU standard, while it is right now a standard applying to toys, if the toy is safe, then the jewelry would be safe if it met the same standards. And that EU standard was adopted and became law in the United States, also for toy products, and TIA can tell you more about that. And it's an ASTM standard that is incorporated into the CPSIA, and it's the standard is F963. So we feel that there's been a lot of research done both in the EU and in the U.S. about that standard, and we very much support it as in this amendment. I would certainly like to entertain your questions. We have a lot of data that we have shared with the senator this morning. Some of it gets into a lot of details as far as the technicalities of producing the products, and I'm not here to cut it short. I'm available to answer all your questions and appreciate everybody's time to consider this issue.
Mr. Gale, thank you. I do have a question. Is the use of cadmium something that's recent because of the bans on lead, or is it something that's been used right along anyway?
It has been used right along. Cadmium, one of the uses of cadmium many hundreds of years is in the solders that are used to hold metals together, including karat gold, sterling silver, brass, and cast metal. It melts at a low temperature, and there was a choice up until 5 years ago for a manufacturer to use a lead-based solder or a cadmium-based solder, and with the restrictions on lead, most firms have gone to a cadmium-based solder. But again, under the standards that the senator has proposed, it would fall way under the allowable limits. As a matter of fact, I will just mention, you might have read about two recent recalls, one at a Claire store, one at a Walmart store. Many of our members test voluntarily to the F963 standard, and while those two products did have cadmium total in it, they both fell well below the standards for 963.
So is that 75 parts per million, is that the 963, or is it?
Yes, it's
what you're referring to?
Same with EN71, and Congress adopted that and just called it F963.
I have a question for you, Senator Higgins. And this all is, I'm asking these questions all because I have a granddaughter, right? And so I relate real.
Veronica.
Yeah, yes. My question is, you're saying children's jewelry, and I guess did we do that with lead as well? But if somebody got costume jewelry, inexpensive costume jewelry, bangles for your wrist or whatever that are really meant for teenagers or adults, would they be likely to have either lead or cadmium in them still? My granddaughter was chewing on some of those bracelets, and I had a fit. And I had no idea, no way to know what was in them. But they were really for an adult, and kids just do that. And I just wondered.
Madam Chair, I think I'll defer to folks in the industry
okay.
to tell us
okay.
that.
Mr. Gale, can you speak to that?
Yes. Everything in our homes is of concern. It's the Clorox in the laundry room. It's the bleach under the sink or the cleaning materials that are under the sink. It's pet foods. It's just absolutely everything in our homes is accessible to our children. There is certainly no way of knowing what is in jewelry, either precious or costume jewelry, that may be handed down from generation to generation. I know my wife has many things that were her mother's and my mother's. And I, like you and maybe some of the others that are a little bit gray at the temples, have granddaughters and grandchildren, and obviously we're all very concerned about what they have access to, just like we're concerned about how they ride in our cars and the swimming pool that you may have in the backyard. We as an industry can go forward, and we have in the last 5 years, because the Minnesota law is one of the few in the nation that also pertains to adult products. Not too many states adopted the law that Minnesota decided to restrict lead in adult products. Most states did not. And what's happened, that became the de facto, because of what Minnesota did, became the de facto national standard, because our members sell to chains that have stores in many states. So if they're going to be allowed to sell it in Minnesota, obviously it's going to be the same standard.
So breaking new ground isn't all bad, Senator Higgins.
Oh, no.
And I appreciate your remarks about the other things. You're absolutely right. It's just, I think it's something that people need to just be more aware of, that there are these things that could have dangerous consequences.
Chair,
yes, Senator Higgins.
Research has shown that cadmium lowers IQ levels even more than lead. It's a really dangerous product. And in 1994, there was a case study published from a child in Toronto who died from cadmium poisoning, and it showed that his brain was swollen, and that the researchers concluded that his exposure came from things around his home, like paint pigments, batteries, and cadmium electroplated utensils. So it's that was 1994, so that's been a while ago. And we'd like to hope that, most of the spatulas in my house are plastic now, so, things have moved to different products. But you can get exposure to these heavy metals in many ways, and I think we can do our part to make sure that there is an exposure to everything. I'm wearing a pin today that was my mother-in-law's pin. So.
And it's beautiful.
And she's been gone for a while. I don't want to know what's in it.
Right, and I understand that. And I think the primary focus on children's jewelry is probably very appropriate. Senator Olson, do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just wondering, Senator Higgins or Mr. Gale, about the part of the bill that exempts nonprofit organizations who are selling this kind of jewelry. And I'm just wondering what the rationale for that was and how that would come up, if that's, a good idea to have that exemption or not.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, we did virtually the same language in the lead bill. This is for the Salvation Armies and the Goodwill and organizations that people donate things to. We didn't want to have the organization be held liable for what was given to them. And so this is consistent with the lead, and this is an idea that Mr. Anderson had from the retailers, and
and we included it in here again. And so maybe Mr. Anderson wants to add to it if I didn't say it well enough.
Mr. Gale, did you want to say something?
Yeah, thank you, Senator, Madam Chair. I also read that story from Toronto that the Senator referred to. I would like to inform all the members of the committee and anyone else who is of interest, who has interested in this, that the main concern about cadmium is inhalation. The general population of the world has more exposure. The number one way that they are exposed to cadmium is through tobacco smoke. There's cadmium in the earth. It gets absorbed into the plant, and if it is if it's made into a product that's going to be burned, such as cigars and cigarettes, right, you know, at our nasal passage, and it's inhaled, that is the main concern of cadmium. In industry, the concern about cadmium is where it's formulated or fabricated, where dust is generated that has cadmium in it. So workers exposed to cadmium are the ones that are at risk. In the Washington Post, and it was a January 14th article in response to the AP article, with no instigation from the jewelry industry, a Dr. John Rosen, who's the chief of environmental sciences at the Children's Hospital in Montefiore in Bronx, New York, said, and I quote, "Very little is known about cadmium's potential health effects on children because it's never been known to be a problem. Pediatricians don't look for it, they aren't knowledgeable about it, and there's not any particular concern about it. It's very good that this issue has come up and out. I'm doubtful that any harm is likely to ensue. If cadmium does have an effect on children through this route, exposure to cadmium containing jewelry, it would be kidney disease," he said. But he adds, "this would constitute a new disease in American children." And there, we have done studies. There has been no reports of injury or death of any children or adult anywhere in the world due to cadmium in jewelry.
And thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gale. Mr. Hackman, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andy Hackman. I'm here on behalf of the Toy Industry Association. We've got about 500-plus members in the United States. We have 9 members here in Minnesota. It's our pleasure to be here, and it's been our pleasure this morning to work with Senator Higgins on this amended draft legislation. As it's been referenced, and I'll echo some of the comments you heard from Mr. Gale, but our industry went through a pretty revolutionary experience over the last 2 years in terms of dealing with federal mandates for a lot of safety factors for our products. I've got a 16-month-old daughter at home, and so this is an issue that's very near and dear to my heart and is a personal issue that I, you know, feel good about representing this industry and going to bed and going to sleep at night. So in terms of our perspective on the legislation, the focus is on children's jewelry. Because certain toys could be considered jewelry, we wanted to make sure that this legislation is consistent with how we are regulated for cadmium and other heavy metals federally. And I am happy to report we have stringent standards for cadmium and other heavy metals for toys that are now federal mandatory law. As a result of the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act, which you heard a lot about already, our ASTM standard 963 is now federal law. CPSC in August of last year took the ASTM standard and made it mandatory binding federal law. So as such, it becomes a part of the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act. The CPSIA does have preemption of state action that's different from the federal regulation, so we wanted to make sure that, again, it's consistent with the standards that we're being regulated to federally. In addition to, because the ASTM standard is a standard that's driven by industry stakeholders that are outside of the industry, including the Consumer Product Safety Commission, that standard is continuously updated to address new information. As Mr. Gale alluded to, our industry is constantly looking to make sure that our standards are the most stringent in the world, And again, I'm happy to report they are the most stringent in the world, and we're looking again into this issue of heavy metals to make sure that we've got the best standards possible federally. So by referring to the ASTM standard in this language, you're ensuring that the standard matches not only for toys but children's jewelry now with the federal standard for toys. And as that standard improves, so will the standard here in Minnesota. So we think it's a good uniform approach to addressing this issue. Specific to our industry, we're happy to have been a part of the group that worked this morning. And as revisions come up, we again appreciate the ability to work with the senator and this committee and other interests as things need to be addressed in the legislation. But again, I appreciate the time and appreciate your consideration and being a proactive state on these safety issues. Thank you.
Mr. Hackman, thank you. Is there anybody else who would like to speak to the legislation? Anybody else? Is that okay? Mr. Anderson indicates he's fine with this.
Madam Chair, I think there's an issue of an effective date.
Okay.
Evidently, people just finished doing all their buying for the next retail cycle. So I'm wondering whether it would be appropriate to have an effective date of, say, January 1st of next year.
That seem
there's a big pillar there where between me and Mr. Anderson.
Industry people think that
is he nodding? Is he shaking?
I don't see any thumbs
that's
down.
Reason.
Okay, no thumbs
you're
down.
Nodding, yes. Okay. So it sounds so we because otherwise we would be August 1st, I guess, and we want to push it out a little further than that. Mr. Gale.
I would respectfully request that it be more mid-year because there as you had mentioned, merchandise is now being made for this holiday season. It's not, as much as we'd like it to all sell during this holiday season, there will be some carryover, and I think a transition period to allow that merchandise to be sold would be appropriate.
And, Mr. Gale, by this holiday season, you mean this coming December, right?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, so.
Well, Madam Chair.
Interesting. You're right. I understand.
Pushing it out 10 months, I think, is about as far as I want to go. I understand that they don't want to throw away merchandise, but let's hope that, I mean, if we set something out so far that it's meaningless, I'm not sure that that's useful to me.
Okay. Senator Olson?
Well, Madam Chair, I can understand pushing it out so that things that are already in inventory have a chance to sell, but I would assume that things that are going to be sold by next holiday season are not ordered yet, you know, and that we would like to prevent people or encourage them not to be ordering things that have that don't meet this standard. And so, you know, I think a fair balance would be the one suggested by Senator Higgins, but the idea would be not to order these potentially dangerous items for next holiday season if we know that this is something, you know, a policy we want to follow.
Mm-hmm. And, Madam Chair, I agree.
Senator Higgins.
If we pass the bill in short order onto judiciary and then onto the floor, our merchandisers will know that this is a standard they're going to have to meet, and if they have not purchased their next round of items, they will know that there is a standard that is different from what is in effect now.
Okay, Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry to just come in on this conversation, and I don't mean to be glib, Senator Higgins, but you should just write a bill to not import any toys from China. That should cover it for the next few years.
So I suspect you're not the first person to have thought of that. So.
What do you want to put January 1 in there? Or what?
So, Senator Metzen, do you want to move?
January 1?
Of 2011. I'll move some of it. So it will just read, Mr. Stanghouse.
Madam Chair, after line 1.20 on the amendment, insert section 2 with a head note of effective date. And this act is effective January 1st, 2011.
Okay. Senator Metzen's.
So moved.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you started to say something. You said so moved. Yes.
Yeah.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. So.
Madam Chair.
Senator Metzen will move.
Yeah, I just want to
Yes.
Give Senator Higgins a lot of credit on this. I mean, she's pulled into manufacturers, retailers, the business community, and worked very diligently with everybody concerned and come up with a pretty good bill, and nobody's out there complaining. So thank you for your work, and I'll move the bill as amended. To the judiciary.
Yes, and Senator Higgins, thank you for bringing this forward, because most of us walk around not knowing that they, you know, about these issues, and so I really appreciate that you brought this bill forward.
Thank you.
Senator Metzen's motion that Senate File 2385 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on the Judiciary, where Senator Higgins and I,
Senator Olson.
Yeah, and Senator Olson will be looking at it again. I suppose I didn't need that. Are there any questions or comments? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. Senator Higgins, thank you. Mr. Gale, Mr. Hackman, thank you.
Thank you all very much.
Mr. Anderson for nodding. Okay.
Good thumbs up.
And Senator Saltzman.
Senator,
thank you.
Good to work with you again. And if needed, so.
Don't leave. That's so bad.
You or your staff.
Where do they go walking on? Okay. Senator Saltzman, welcome to our committee.
Thank you very much. It is great to be back, Madam Chair, and I do have Senate File 1886 with me today.
Yes.
And I also have an A2 amendment. And I
wonder.
And wondered,
that's being handed out. Yes.
Right. I wondered if I could ask Mr. Stang a question about the A2 amendment.
Of course.
On lines 2.10, it refers to within the 48-hour period, and I believe we dropped another 48-hour period because we don't really know how long the contract, until the contract is in effect, because they're waiting for an adjuster. So if we drop within the 48-hour period, would that then cover any emergency services a roofer might perform between when they sign a contract and when the adjuster potentially denies the claim? Because I'm not sure that a 48-hour period is entirely accurate. Should I explain that, Madam Chair?
Well, Senator Saltzman, I'm taking it. I haven't read this, but I think you have. It's the right of rescission, a 48-hour rescission period. So if there were any work performed within that 48 hours,
She might be suggesting that there might be work between the time before that.
Right.
I think maybe she's correct that there's some.
So Saltzman's perhaps correct. Drop that, Madam Chair, because what we're doing here is that they may sign a contract, but then the adjuster doesn't come for anywhere from 3 to 10 days or whatever. Right. So that's why I'm suggesting that cover, because probably the emergency services were done more immediately after the event.
Windows boarded up, that right. kind of thing. Okay,
right.
Sure. I understand.
So I'd like to ask for the A2 to be introduced, and then dropping within the 48-hour period from lines 2.9 and 2.10.
Madam Chair.
Just dropping those last two lines. So we, and I don't think we
just
we don't need a motion to that.
We can just incorporate it in our amendment.
We just incorporate into Senator Saltzman's amendment, removing within the 48-hour period. And leaving the comma. So it will read, however, if the residential roofer has performed any emergency services, the residential roofer is entitled to compensation for such
Correct.
Services. That's how you wish it to read. And I think Senator Scogin
then
will move the A2 amendment. And it's as I just read. Correct. So this will put the bill in the shape Senator Saltzman would prefer. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed,
aye.
Same sign. The motion prevails. Okay, Senator Saltzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do want to just note that this bill is really a consumer protection bill, and that there are many reputable contractors in our state, but in this particular instance, there are times when people take advantage of perhaps some loopholes in our laws, and we really want to tighten them up, because it's really important that our insurance companies do cover these claims, but But at the same time, some of the advertising methods and the contracts are not always in the best interest of our consumers. So what this bill essentially does is addresses the fact that many times roofing companies, especially after a storm, will go out and market their services, but oftentimes then they offer on their advertising to offer that a person's deductible can be waived or that they will pick up the deductible if they particularly go with this particular contractor. And so you have an example, I believe, that is being passed out that has an example of where marketing is done, and instead of a insurer being responsible for their deductible, they may be given special deals. And that really is illegal. And so we want to make that very clear. In addition, we also want to address through this bill the fact that when a person signs a contract with a roofing company, that if their claim is then denied, that this person has the ability to then cancel the contract. And so that is the second part of this bill, and prescribe some very specific language that would be shared with people when they do sign a contract. So I'd like Mr. Johnson to maybe elaborate a little bit more on this. Again, the insurance industry wants to cover storm damage, but at the same time, we want to make sure that business practices also protect those people who are following the law, and that's the intent of this bill. Mr. Johnson.
Welcome, Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota, and we appreciate the chance to be here today and speak in support of Senate File 1886. I think Senator Salzman really targeted the key provisions in the bill. It's very focused now. It deals with the marketing practices, if you will, of roofing contractors, and I think as Senator Salzman indicated, I think the majority of roofing contractors, this is probably a more of a minority a number of contractors, but they're very aggressive tactics and practices, and particularly following storms. And we've had some very significant hailstorms in Minnesota in the last 2 years, very significant hail numbers, both in volume of claims. And so I think from our industry's perspective, this really deals with a situation that's just flat confusing to consumers. If I buy a homeowner's policy and I have a $1,000 deductible, I know that if there's a covered loss, the first $1,000 is mine. I buy that deductible. And so if a storm hits and a marketing rep comes to the door, and as Senator Salzman pointed out, we have other examples, I get literature, and it's posed to me as I get a free roof. You'll see that we have a lot of materials that we can show you that use that. At a minimum, it's very confusing to consumers because they know they have a deductible, and obviously it's a method to generate business. And so this is an issue that really the bill, I have to tell you, the origins of it came out of some meetings that our industry had with Commissioner Glenn Wilson in the department, because they similarly get calls and complaints from consumers, and in the aftermath of some, again, these significant hailstorms, that this issue just repeatedly was coming up. So I think from our perspective, again, this is a focused, targeted a proposal and remedy. It's actually patterned. Some of you that have been around for a few years may remember a decade ago or so, a similar issue came up in the area of advertisements and freebies and what have you with auto glass dealers. And so Minnesota, no, we're not going back.
You know,
right?
We're
going
to get something set up so that when somebody says auto glass, I
don't mean to get in trouble here, but I do want to point out that we have a statute, 325F.783, just to give you the reference, that a decade ago this committee and the legislature acted very strongly and actually with support of the auto glass industry to put in a similar prohibition that auto glass dealers cannot offer to pay any or part of a deductible or give any gift or inducement or incentive or freebie. And I think from our industry's perspective, I think the last decade or so, that law and dealing with that particular, you know, at its height, you may recall newspaper ads that said $500 cash back if we come to your driveway to put in a windshield. I think everyone properly asked, you can't give back $500 cash to put in a $200 windshield. So the point is this, is that we've got a track record in Minnesota law on this exact same kind of principle. We think it's a measured, focused response. I think the fact situation that Senator Saltzman commented on is actually a real fact situation where a marketing rep, and the case that actually generated this for us was a senior citizen in Minnesota, had a marketing rep for a roofing company come, knock, say you get a free roof. Contract was signed. That contract then was sent into the insurance company. That was their first notice of the claim. They went out and examined the roof, and they said, it's not damaged. You don't get a roof. And that's a terrible situation to put a consumer in, to have a signed contract for a $10,000 roof. And if the roofing company rips it up, fine, but they don't have to. It's a signed contract. So we think it's very targeted, narrowed, tailored to remedy a fact situation that we think is unacceptable. I just conclude, Madam Chair, that the bill has very broad-based support within the industry, the professional PIA, the professional insurance agents, the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers, the Minnesota Association of Farm Mutual Insurance Companies. I've met with the Builders Association of Minnesota. I've met with the Minnesota Association of Exterior Contractors. You know, that's a group that Senator Roger Moe works with. And they're not supporting, but I don't believe there's anybody here to object to the bill. And I think that speaks to the focused nature of it and how we're trying to tailor a statutory solution here to some specific problem. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Johnson, believe it or not, I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Another. Senator Olson.
I see this as a piece of consumer protection legislation, and I can think of a couple of particular examples within my own family's situation following storms where, I had one family member where someone came out and solicited, said, let me check out your roof. Honestly, in that situation, my family member had no idea that there might have been a problem with their roof, but it turns out there was a problem with their roof, and both the insurance company and the roofer agreed, and the insurance company paid for it. Yeah. And so, but because it was an aggressive marketing tactic, like you said, I would not have wanted to see that family member locked into a contract if there actually had not been damage. And so I do see that this goes on, and it seems to me that this isn't giving anything other than just more rights to a consumer in that situation. I had another family member following a storm where the whole neighborhood had damage, and some had their roofs taken care of without a lot of difficulty, and others had a real fight. So, but the only thing I have to always find something to disagree with you about, I'm sorry, but, I'm not sure that I necessarily agree with you, however. I agree offering $500 for a $200 deductible and all of that is an enticement that's improper, but I'm not sure that I necessarily agree that a consumer shouldn't be able to do the same kind of negotiating on their deductible that an insurance company does all the time in trying to reduce what it has to pay. And so I don't know that I'm necessarily quite as far as you are in that direction, but I think this is a good piece of legislation.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Saltzman, I totally get the second part of your bill, and I think that makes a lot of sense, but I'm not understanding exactly how the first part is going to work.
Senator Johnson, do you mean
the
first part?
Deductible part.
Okay, Senator Saltzman.
So on that point, Madam Chair, and Senator Johnson, I will attempt to explain it, and then if Mr. Johnson wants to sort of suggest that. If you have a deductible of, say, $1,000 on your house, what is essentially happening is that some companies who are advertising will say, we'll waive the $1,000 and we'll absorb it ourselves, when in reality, they're probably padding their claim to the insurance company or adding it on somewhere else, or else potentially using a lesser quality product. And so when you have damage to your house, I've had some water damage at some point in time, we expect to pay the deductible. And if a company comes in and then says, because that is essentially what is happening, is that they're passing the costs on many times to the insurance company with an additional bill. And companies who are out there, you know, competing and are following the law are really then not on a level playing field, because oftentimes these costs show up another way. And so, Mr. Johnson, is that accurate? I mean, because you're seeing that in terms of the claims that are turned in, because there is an initial assurance insurance claim, but then I believe that the roofers also have to submit paperwork if they find additional damage once they start the project. There may be additional damage to the roof that they want to have covered, some structural damage that wasn't seen in the first
estimate.
Right, the estimate. I was thinking the right word here. So I think that's where we just want to make it very clear that when you sign a contract with your insurance company, you agree to pay that particular deductible. Mr. Johnson, would that be accurate?
Senator Johnson, just following up, and then Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Sulzman, I just went through this entire process this summer. And my insurance company has a policy to not pay an inflated rate, and they tell the contractor that directly to their face. What I feel about the first half of your bill is that the industry, because it's become so competitive with all the catastrophe claims we have going on, that not only is the consumer getting extremely educated in a very fast period of time, but so is the contractors. They're getting out there, and they're making their work competitive. You're talking about a few bad apples, just a few, because mostly people are trying to do good services. So I'm just not convinced about the first part of your bill.
Okay. Did you want to respond, Senator Sulzman? Mr. Johnson.
Right. Perhaps Mr. Johnson could show some more specific examples of what they're seeing in the industry.
I think, Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I think the key thing here is this is very focused in terms of the activities by the building contractors in terms of selling, marketing roofs. And from our perspective, anybody that's going to come to the door as a potential vendor or working on the house and to use the phrase, you know, you get a free roof or we'll pay your deductible, that doesn't change how the insurance company, they're going to adjust the loss based on the deductible that the consumer has chosen, period. So it ends up being, it's a point of confusion for the consumer. I think the insurer will ultimately is going to work out the compensation with the builder. And as Senator Sulzman kind of described, there's oftentimes a process where as you're doing work, there may be some supplemental bills that come up in the course of it, and that'll get handled. But this really is to deal with that upfront transaction the way we did with in the auto glass situation to alleviate the confusion, and it is just flat confusing. I'll just share with Senator Johnson and the committee that insurance companies and agents have to deal with these marketing brochures and advertisements to explain to their customers you still have a deductible. The loss is going to be adjusted based on what you chose as a deductible. So it's generating confusion. And admittedly, it is a minority numerically of contractors, and many don't do it. And I think the contractors themselves, Senator Sulzman has some letters that Minnesota contractors have written that have urged passage of the bill because they view it as an unfair advantage to contractors that are doing that because they're telling the consumer something that's actually not true. It's not free in the sense that your deductible is going to apply, period. That's how they're going to adjust the claim. Yeah. And so to say that it's not going to apply, it's actually just not true. So I think it is an important, just a consumer protection, to make it clear that what they bought is what they're going to get when that. And again, most contractors don't do that practice, and they're well able to compete. You know, word of mouth, when storms happen, we had one in our neighborhood, a locally damaging hail, and 132 homes in a development, all 132 got roofs, and after the storm, sometimes it was got crowded with cars at night from the marketing reps, and I'm okay with that because you sort through it, but I think those, and most of them came up and said, can I give you a bid on your roof? That's fine. so you get a bid on the roof. But for those that said you get it free, I told them to go away because I said, I'm paying my deductible. That's what I bought, and you're not going to make it go away. So I think it is it's an important, and consumers are learning about it. But I just think let's help consumers not have to deal with, and I don't think it hurts, in my opinion, I don't think it's hurting the business because the roofs are still going to get replaced or repaired. And when the storms hit, all of that work's still going to take place. But let's help alleviate that confusion.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, and going back to revisiting what I was saying before, and I apologize, I was looking at the A2 amendment, and I wasn't putting it together with what was in the rest of your bill. And I kind of understand what Mr. Johnson's saying, but I don't think it's quite as simple as that, because the insurance company has to pay whatever sort of the market cost of doing the job. And sometimes the insurance company asks for deals to be made. In fact, all the time that I can think of, the insurance company is asking for deals to be made, sometimes to get people to do something for a lesser price in order to take advantage of their business, to get their business, especially if they can get volume business or something like that. So they put a lot of pressures wherever they can to be able to pay the lowest amount of money. Now, I'm not saying there's necessarily anything wrong with that. I'm just saying that they engage in that practice. Now, the question is whether a consumer has the right to do the same thing to try to get the best deal. If there's a market price for replacing your roof, if it needs to be replaced, who gets the benefit of whatever deduction or deal lower than the market value that might come into play, a deal that the consumer cuts with the person replacing the roof to get that applied toward the deductible, or a deal with the insurance company in order to get, you know, whatever negotiation they're able to come up with. I agree with Mr. Johnson that we don't want consumers caught in the middle of that kind of deal making where they think they have one deal and then the insurance company says, well, heck, if you could find someone who will do it for this price, we're still going to apply your deductible, and so it still applies, sort of as Mr. Johnson was saying. But I'm not sure that the answer to that is that clear, you know, and in that kind of fight you'd have between the two, who wins and loses that, I'm not quite sure, because it's not necessarily who gets the benefit of some special deal. It's kind of what the market price would be, I think.
Mr. Johnson.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Olson, if I can just comment, I think you're describing a little bit more detail in terms of what the consumer is doing when a storm hits. So my roof got hail damage. I called my agent. The company came out and inspected it. And really, my job at that point, I mean, I'm not doing the shopping. The insurance company is contractually obligated to return that, you know, to pay for the covered damage as the contract, you know, provides, so to return it to the pre-loss condition. I'm not engaged in kind of the shopping of prices. That's going to be done back once I pick a contractor, which I get to do. And so if I want to go with, XYZ company, and I sign that contract, now the negotiation is going to go back and forth between XYZ and the insurer, and I'm not going to be at the table kind of as part of that process. They do work that out. I'm going to be paying my deductible. But I really am not involved other than the initial choice, who do I want to do business with, and I get to make that choice. But other than that, I'm not really negotiating between the, if it's a roofing company or whatever, the contractor and the homeowner's insurer. They're going to be going back and forth working out the payment for what the covered, you know, damages were to the property.
Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, I can envision lots of situations where what happens is the homeowner does notify the insurance company that there's been damage, and they send an adjuster out. And a lot of times insurance adjusters will tell you what they're allowing to pay, and they base it on, you know, what they feel the market rate is in the area. Now, let's just say that an insurance company comes out and they tell me that they're allowing $10,000 to replace my roof. Now, I find somebody who comes along and says, okay, the $10,000 is the going rate, and you're going to have to pay $1,000 of that under your deductible, but I really want the business because I'm out of work and I'm willing to do it for $9,000. Now, under your bill, the the consumer, the homeowner, would have to hand that extra money, basically that could have been used toward their deductible, back to the insurance company, because they would not be able to say tell them that they would apply this toward their deductible.
Madam Chair, I think Senator Olson, I think as you look at the wording of section, whatever the section of the bill is now,
the original section three,
mm-hmm. It only addresses, the only part of the transaction that this bill addresses is that the roofer that's providing those services can't advertise or promise to pay. So all we're dealing with is the practices of the roofer, if you will, in the solicitation of business. This doesn't go to anything other than that. So similar to what we do with the auto glass, all we're dealing with is the advertising end of the transaction, period.
The enticement to do business.
It's,
but once you have, I was thinking, Senator Olson, this is addressing what happens before you have found the roofing contractor to do your roof. And I don't think it precludes, I don't know.
It doesn't impact anything other than that. This is drafted and intended. It only deals with that part of the transaction. In other words, what are the roofers doing in their marketing practices to get business? It has no impact on once somebody has picked somebody. It doesn't affect that part of the transaction at all.
So, Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I understand we're saying that on the record, but to me that isn't perfectly clear from the language. And so if Senator Salzman would be able to work with me, I would feel more comfortable at the final version of this if we made very clear that that's all we're intending to impact is just on the solicitation side.
Mm-hmm. Senator Salzman.
And I'm willing to do that. The other thing is that there are some people who do go to their insurance company directly and find out they have damage, and they take the claim and the money, and they may put the roof on themselves and save significant dollars. Now, if they take the money and they don't fix the roof, then I believe that if they have future damage, that they're not insured. Is that correct, Mr. Johnson, in some cases, that if you take a claim and keep the money and don't make repairs and later on have water damage, that you could be at risk if you...
I'm going to look for... There's a Mr. claim Johnson. Manager. Can I call a friend to...
I don't need to ask that question, but I think that there are some decisions that, you know, that consumers make. And...
Welcome. Can you help?
No, thank you. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee... First of all, I need you to introduce yourself. I'm sorry. I was actually going to get to that in a second. But my name is Kevin Hollick. I'm a property claims manager for Farmers Insurance here in the state of Minnesota. I've been with Farmers for 14 years. I spent 9 of those years working for our catastrophe response team in various states throughout the country. So I do feel like I have some personal insight to offer on the subject, and I welcome the opportunity to come in and discuss this matter with you because it's something near and dear to us. We deal with it frequently, and it is a problem. In reference to the deductible, we kind of got sidetracked into a different topic, so would you like me to talk about the...
Question that
question first about
Senator Salzman had.
If you don't use...
Yeah, the question was if you don't...
Did you say Holly?
Hollick is my last name, yes.
How do you spell it?
H-O-L-O-C-H.
Okay, and it's Kevin?
Kevin, yes.
Kevin Hollick. Thank you. Mr. Hollick, proceed.
Okay. The question was if you get paid for damages on a homeowner's claim and you do not complete those repairs, would there be a potential denial for further damage because of your failure to complete the repairs and that potential... would exist if you have a covered loss, we pay you for that damage, and you fail to complete those repairs. There could be a potential for a denial in the future if you have additional damages as a result. That's
Senator Olson.
Just to offer a little clarification, I think I'm right here, and you'll tell me hopefully if I'm wrong. But the insurance company wants to make sure they're not paying for the same thing twice. And so, you know, you'd have to be able to distinguish. Well, first of all, you probably have a mortgage. If you do, it's going to require you to make those repairs. Or if you have a car loan. But in the absence of that, if you don't owe any money, the insurance company may have something in its contract with you that says that you assert at the time that you take out insurance that everything is in good repair, and that could be used to negate a further claim if you didn't do it. And even in light of, but in the absence of something like that, it's probably going to come down to whether by not making those repairs you contributed to something that was going to, that caused the loss because you failed to make the repair, or if it was just a second independent act.
Yeah, a tree
nature.
Fell on the roof
right.
The second time. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
We're nodding.
Okay.
That is correct. In reference to the Section 3 regarding rebating of deductibles, promising to pay or offset a portion or all of a deductible if you, the insured or policyholder, signs up with that particular insurance or particular roofing company, we do see that, or we do hear of that practice from our policyholders out there. I think one thing that has not necessarily been discussed is, and I believe it's kind of been touched on as far as the enticement goes, it's more of if you're offering or promising as a condition of signing a contract that we will pay, being the roofing company, will pay your deductible or somehow get your deductible back, I think is where the confusion with the policyholders is coming in. I've seen some kind of offshoots of practices very similar to this that are going on not only in this state but other locations throughout the country. And what it's really designed to do is make a representation to the insured that you as a roofing company are going to get them something. And a lot of the times, the homeowners don't know if they have damage. So the first kind of discussion they have is with a roofer that has knocked on their door and said, "Please let me go up on your roof. I'll see if you have damage." They come down and say, "Yes, you have damage. Sign with me. I will do this, this, and this." One of them being, "We will pay for your deductible." And what they use to kind of satisfy the insured at the time is they basically consider it marketing or advertising costs, because they will say, "Allow me to put a yard sign in your yard. That is what your deductible will pay you for. That is what me paying your deductible is doing. It's offsetting my advertising or marketing expenditures." So again, I think it's representing something to the insured, whether it be they know there's damage, and a lot of the claims we get are for claims just like this, where the roofer has said there is damage. So they have basically convinced the insured to file a claim with us. We go out there and we find it is, in fact, does not have any damage. At that point, a contract probably has already been signed. I've seen numerous examples where contracts get signed by the insured with a dollar amount, and then when it comes back in for the supplements that have been referencing, it is for tens of thousands of dollars more at times. I've seen some other techniques being used, such as they will take the insured to a notary, have them sign a proof of loss swearing to their loss and dollar amount of their loss, have it get notarized, submit it back into us, and one of the caveats of this is basically assignment of benefits over to the roofing contractor. I have anecdotal evidence. I have had some situations where this has happened, and speaking with the insured, the roofing contractor took them to the notary, drove them, as an elderly insured, drove them to the notary, had them sign and notarize a blank contract, and then we had them submit the initial contract to us, and it was for X number of dollars. When the work was done and he was submitting for the final amount, it was actually $20,000 more than what he had the insured sign up for.
So I don't know if this bill will address that problem, but I think the problem is what's used to entice the person into the contract in the first place, and nobody can interfere with your contract with your insurance company, which is your policy. You have a $1,000 deductible. You owe it, and I see why people get confused when the contractor says, "Well, we're paying that. You don't have to pay it." They have no authority to to do that. Now, you can have a contract with them, and you can have other arrangements with them, I guess, separate from your contract with your insurance company, but it seems to me that people are being taken advantage of terribly here. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sure that that part does go on, but in the language of this, starting on Section 3.1, this is my interpretation of the way it's written, shall not be obligated to consider the estimate prepared by the residential roofer is giving the insurance company the ability to deny a contract that the homeowner has worked out with the company. So that's the language in here that I think can be used incorrectly and needs to be modified.
Oh, you're 3.11, 11. I'm sorry, because...
Starting on 3.1 to 3.11.
Well, 3.1 is not in the bill anymore, but... So the Section 1 and 2 have been taken from the bill, I think.
Mm-hmm. This is in Section 3.
Madam Chair? Only Section 3. Yes, Senator Olson.
Speaking to the point, though, that Senator Johnson is referring to, the only time they would have to disregard that estimate would be if the roofer violated the section by basically putting that kind of an enticement into the language. Otherwise, the insurance companies would have to, you know, consider. I mean, they're not obligated to take the estimate if they don't agree with it, but they would certainly have to consider it.
Right.
Right.
Okay. So is...
Is that Senator Johnson? Is that...
Madam Chair.
Senator Sparks.
Thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Saltzman, for your amendment. I think that that did tighten it up. And if I'm correct, and Mr. Johnson, maybe you can help too, you're really focusing on the marketing piece. You're still going to allow the roofers to do the work if they need to do the work, right?
Madam Chair, Senator Sparks, absolutely. Okay. It's the marketing. That's the whole focus of the bill.
And Madam Chair, I think that that's a good idea, but I think that that's an important piece too, because I know that Mr. Hollick talked about some of the examples that he had, and we had a tornado that came through Austin on June 17th of this last year, and I was there and helping some friends, and I saw firsthand what happened. But at the same time, I think it's important that we take this out. But if we just relied on the local contractors and we have that kind of devastation and there's a hole in your roof, we want to make sure that those roofs can be repaired as fast. I'm sure Senator Vanderveer saw similar things in Hugo, so I think that that's the important thing, that we know that we don't want this stuff happening, but we still want those roofers to be able to do the work that they need to do.
Senator Olson.
And, Madam Chair, that's why I don't think, you know, on its own, there's nothing wrong with, per se, an assignment of benefits of your insurance payment. I mean, if a roofer is going to start working, they want to know that they're going to get paid. And like Senator Sparks said, if you've got a hole in your roof, they're going to want some protection. So, no, assigning a payment and having it notarized is just a way of them protecting the fact that they know they're going to get paid for the work they do. So I don't see anything wrong with that. But it seems to me that that setting people up for a situation where they are believing that, you know, giving them an out if there's a difference of an opinion with the insurance company about whether there was damage, so that people aren't pressured into getting something they don't think is, or being promised something that isn't accurate. I think to the extent that the bill does that, I definitely support it.
And the bill will go to Judiciary. Any further? Is there anybody else here who would like to testify to the bill? Senator Vanderveer?
Thank you. Is the public adjuster out of this now?
Yes, it is.
Yes, Senator Vanderveer. The amendment took out Sections 1 and 2. It added new language, but it left Section 3. Nobody else would like to testify? Senator Sparks then moves that Senate File 1886, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion prevails, and... thank you very much. The bill is recommended to the and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank
Senator
you
Saltzman,
much,
thank
Chair.
You. Thank Gentlemen, you. Mr. Hollick, Mr. Johnson, thank you.
Thank you.
And now, Senator Sparks would like to chair the committee.
He would.
How do you know? Do you?
But I do agree that people should have given the choice to have
Senator Shine, whenever you're well ready.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 2512, and I do have an author's amendment. It is the A1.
Okay, Senator Scheid would like to offer the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is legislation that is brought to me by the Minnesota Association of Realtors. And it's an effort, as they have, I think, been known to do over the years, have worked long and hard to improve the professionalism, increase the professionalism of the real estate profession. And this is another example of that. There's four components in here, and I think that that's still true even with the amendment. We just softened some language in here in the author's amendment, I think. It was actually an amendment worked out with the Department of Commerce and the Realtors Association. So what we have here is it creates a module system for real estate continuing education. And the module, we spent some time looking up that word. And as it relates to education, it's just a piece, a specific topic, a part of the whole. So when there are hot topics within the industry, when there are things of current concern, current issues that, and our bill originally, it said that the commissioner, and I think, decides what those topics would be. And, I mean, we've had those kinds, I think we had this with human rights legislation and fair housing kinds of issues over the years that have become important topics at that particular moment in time, if you will. And then we've actually, I think, legislated requirements for that kind of education. Well, this gives the commissioner the opportunity to determine what those topics are and the original bill asked the commissioner to develop that, the module, the program, and the testing, but the language of the amendment says that the commissioner could delegate the module and the development of the test to, subject to the commissioner's own approval, if you will, to a statewide real estate trade association. So I think that is something the department wanted to do and not to not have the sole responsibility for determining what the modules had to be. In any case, so and there's a requirement in here for testing on those modules, whatever they may be, and perhaps Ms. Berger can give you an idea of the kinds of things that we might see there. Then this bill also addresses brokers, and actually I think that's in the beginning language. Instead of requiring 2 years of experience before obtaining a broker's license, we are asking they must be a salesperson for 3 years before they can obtain a broker's license. That is to improve the quality, the knowledge, the experience of the brokers, because brokers do have the responsibility for everybody working for them. This is a piece of improving the professionalism here. And then we ask for the modules also then for brokers. And I think I would ask Ms. Berger to speak to the bill, if you would.
Ms. Berger, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Christine Berger, and I represent the 20,000 members of the Minnesota Association of Realtors. And Senator Scheid, as always, did a phenomenal job of describing what the bill exactly does in further enhancing real estate licensee professionalism through changes to our continuing education. One thing she asked me to just highlight is, what would be some of the topics of these modules. And, you know, we're thinking of hot and current industry topics of significance in the marketplace, like short sales and foreclosures, how to transact with short sales and foreclosures, practice tips, laws, rules, and regulations, how to work with lenders, et cetera, so that everyone in the industry has the latest and greatest information. On the broker modules, it would be things like increasing their professionalism through learning more about our contractual forms, our transactional forms, the office management, broker management, or just various things that brokers need to be on top-notch about. So anyway, that's kind of the what the modules will be covering, and we just ask for your support. The industry, if I may just go into the process, we did vet this. We had a task force that met for actually quite a while. We went through our governmental affairs committee, which has statewide representation, and went through our board of directors, which has statewide representation. Then we actually took it on the road and went to a lot of our local boards across the state, if not all of them, most of them, and got local board of approval as well. So we really vetted this through the whole industry.
Thank you, Ms. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this seems to me like a great idea. I'm just wondering, one thing, for example, that occurs to me that you might want to know about now is just kind of the change in qualifications for financing, because there's been a real shift in what it takes for people to qualify to buy a loan. But then going one step farther than that, I wonder whether there's any discussion about ethical responsibilities, if real estate brokers have ethical responsibilities as they talk to customers about putting themselves in, I mean, after we've seen what's happening with the housing market and everything, you know, you might technically qualify for something, but is it really a good idea? I don't know if the real estate agent or broker has any responsibilities in that area or not.
Ms. Berger,
I know. Can respond to that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I'm just busting at the seams to answer this question. We are very excited to tell you that on top of what this legislation does, we as a realtor board, as a realtor organization from the state, will be, when we've sought this through our local board approval, that there will be additional ethics training for brokers that will be required on top of, in order for them to renew their membership with as a realtor. They need to do a four-year, every 4 years, the National Association of Realtors requires realtors to take an ethics course every 4 years. We will now say they need to take an additional broker ethics training course on top of what the National Association of Realtors requires. That part did not require legislation, so it's, you don't see it here, but we are adding additional ethics classes for our brokerages.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, I don't...
Senator Shai.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if there's any other questions from the committee, or if there's anybody else that wants to testify. Otherwise, I'd move the bill.
Okay, we'll find out. Anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 2512? Any further comments from the committee? Seeing none, Senator Scheid moves that Senate File 2512 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator.
Chairman, thank you, and we will have bills again on Thursday. Thank you for good questions today.
Thank you. With that, meeting adjourned.